We've been exploring Jesus as we find him in Matthew's Gospel. And over these past number of weeks together, we've discovered some things about him. For example, we've discovered that he teaches with authority. We spent 6 weeks walking through the Sermon on the Mount and discovering how Jesus' teaching was so different to what the people were used to, because Jesus' teaching was with authority. And then when he came down from the mountain, we discovered that he exercised that authority. He then demonstrated that the authority he claimed, he actually possessed. Because when he was faced by various difficulties and forms of opposition, he met with them. So he exercises authority over disease, over space, over nature, over demons. And last Sunday we discovered even over sin. But this month, we will realize that it is not just from winds and waves that Jesus expects obedience. We're going to discover this month that Jesus expects obedience from us. He expects to have authority over us, over our lives, over our decisions, over our priorities, over who we are and what we do. And there are four simple commands that we're going to look at. We've entitled the series The Jesus Ultimatum. And it's pretty obvious, if you could even vaguely see the screen, what the first word is today. It's big enough. In the Matthew narrative, the period after the healing of the paraplegic that we talked about last week, which is Matthew chapter 9 verses 1 to 8, that amazing healing, you know, where Jesus forgave a man's sins as well as set him free to walk. And that was in the first eight verses of Matthew chapter 9. Between that and the passage we're at today is a truly rich time in Jesus' life. Because if you had time to look back, flick back over those verses that we're not going to talk about this morning, you discover that during that time, Jesus heals a woman who had been hemorrhaging for 12 years and who had tried every other form of medical help and it had failed her. Jesus healed her in an instant. He heals two blind men. He heals a demon-possessed man who is mute, cannot speak. As a result of demon possession, he casts the demon out and he makes him speak. They're all healed. And in the middle of those healings, a small girl, the daughter of a synagogue ruler, is raised to life. It was an incredibly rich period of time. Small wonder, therefore, that the crowds who witnessed all this said, "Nothing like this has ever been seen in Israel. Nothing like this. We've never seen anything like this before." Such a rich period of signs and wonders of the power of God in Jesus' ministry. And in verse 35, we have the normal summarized in these verses. It says this is what would normally happen. Jesus went through all the towns and villages, teaching in their synagogues, proclaiming the good news of the kingdom, and healing every disease and sickness. This is what Jesus did. It was just normal activity. In the Greek language, the New Testament is written in those verbs, teaching, proclaiming, healing, are in the imperfect tense. That means it was something Jesus was keeping on doing. It was just happening all the time. But Jesus did not intend to be the only one for whom this was a way of life. Because just a few verses later, and we'll be thinking about it next Sunday, just a few verses later, he sends the disciples out to do the same. He gives them almost the same command, almost the same details you have in that verse he tells them to do. And we think about that next Sunday. And it's in the context of this experience, of this rich time in Jesus' life, when the people are being healed, and when the disciples are being sent out, it's in this context we find the four words that we're going to be thinking about in the month of June. Jesus' experience in public ministry gives us the first word, the word ask. See, in public ministry, Jesus saw lots of people. Most of those people were, of course, members of the people of God. They were Israelites. And as Jesus looks at these people, whom he's meeting day by day in the experience of his public ministry, as he looks at these people, he has a picture. A picture comes into his head. We read this. When he saw the crowds, he had compassion on them because they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. Now, I don't know about you, but when you read those words, especially in that translation of the NIV, when you read those words and you think about being harassed and helpless, you think about your everyday life, you know? All the stuff you've got to do, all the challenges and problems that you have, you know, you're harassed every day, harassed at work by the telephone or the boss, you know, helpless because there's so many things you'd like to do, but you haven't the time and you haven't the resources, and anyway, you have to think about your kids and your husband or your wife or somebody else. Harassed and helpless. And we kind of have a picture in our minds that Jesus is looking at everyday life, but of course that isn't what Jesus has in mind at all. Because those two verbs, the verb harassed and helpless, those two things that Jesus describes are something completely different. To be harassed means to be mangled by wild beasts. And to be helpless means to be lying on the ground mortally wounded. Picture Jesus has in his mind is of sheep worried by a dog. If you've ever seen sheep worried by a dog, then you'll know what a truly horrendous and devastating experience that is. And that's what the words harassed and helpless mean. And that's the picture that Jesus has in his mind. He looks at the people of God, remember. This is not the Gentiles. This is the nation of Israel. He looks at the people of God, and that's what he sees. What can Jesus possibly mean? Well, it had to be the case that Jesus has in his mind a prayer that Moses prayed in the Old Testament. In Numbers chapter 27, Moses is praying about the future. He's reflecting on the fact that he will not always lead Israel, and that someday he will die and he will be taken away, and he's asking God about the future. And this is what he says. May the Lord appoint someone over this community, one who will lead them out, bring them in, so that the Lord's people will not be like sheep without a shepherd. This has to be the picture. This picture in Jesus' mind has to be in the context of those verses he will have known so well from Moses' prayer. Moses was praying, Lord, when I go, make sure that there's someone else who can come in here and who can lead your people so that they won't be like sheep without a shepherd. Jesus is saying that Israel is not being led. Now, how absurd was that? Because Israel was coming down with leaders, priests and high priests, Herod and Herodians, Pharisees and Sadducees and scribes and zealots. There was any number of them who were in positions of leadership, yet Jesus looks at the people and what does he see? Worried sheep. People without leadership. The answer to that prayer of Moses was Joshua. What was so distinctive about Joshua? Well, you remember what it says about him, that there was the tent of meeting where Moses would go, where he would receive word from the Lord, and he would leave the tent and he would go out to the people. But it says in the Old Testament that when Moses left the tent, Joshua didn't leave, he stayed alone. He lingered in the presence of the Lord. And so in giving to the people of Israel a Joshua, God gave to them a leader who was more interested in what God wanted than what the people wanted. Because isn't that the hallmark of Moses' leadership? For most of his time as the leader of Israel, they all thought he was either mad or useless. Frustrated with him and angry at God. You know, you brought us out of Egypt, we're not to eat, you brought us out of Egypt, and we don't have this and we don't have that. And throughout virtually the totality of his leadership, they were against him, complaining about him and shaking their fists at God. Of course, once he died, he was the best thing since sliced bread. That's the way things happen in life. But while he was alive and while he was leading, he was not giving people what they wanted. He was following the fire and the cloud. He was more concerned about what God wanted than what people wanted. And he sought to lead the people where God wanted them to go. And Joshua was just such a leader. He was a person who lingered in the tent. He was more concerned to hear what God had to say than to hear the moaning and complaining and backbiting and disagreements that were going on amongst the people of God all around him. That was the kind of leader he was. And obviously Jesus thought that such people were lacking in his day. And so the enemy was devastating the flock. So this was in Jesus' mind. And as Jesus looked at these circumstances, he saw an amazing thing. It's not what you would expect. When Jesus looks and he sees the people of God like worried sheep, you'd think he'd be thinking to himself, it's all over, it's finished, what's the point? And yet Jesus' conclusion was exactly the opposite. Jesus sees this as a day of opportunity. The picture in his mind changes from the flock to the crop. The harvest is plentiful, he says, but the workers are few. And when he sends the disciples out, just a few verses later, he sends them out as reapers into a plentiful harvest. He expects results, not just faithfulness. That's the amazing thing about God, that God doesn't usually involve people in ministry for vain reasons. He doesn't send people out to be a failure. He sends people out into a plentiful harvest field. Did you ever notice something about Jesus? In the New Testament, he described his disciples as what? Fishermen. The earliest call he makes, that's what he says to them. Leave your boats and come with me. I'm going to make you fish for men and women. Jesus only sent his disciples out fishing on two occasions in the Gospels. Literally fishing, in a boat for real fish. And on both of those occasions, they brought back such a haul of fish that in the first instance, it almost sank the boat and they had to get their friends to come and help them land the catch. And on the second occasion, there were so many fish that they actually counted them. And John's Gospel records there were 153 fish in the net. Go figure. What is Jesus saying? He says, I'm sending you out to be fishermen, not to come back with a paltry catch, but to come back with an overflowing net and a sinking boat full of people who are redeemed and rescued. So, when God's people are properly led, there will be fruit. That's the promise. When God's people are properly led, the enemy will not devastate among the flock. And there will be fruit. There will be fish in the net. How will that happen? Jesus said it will happen if we ask. It will happen if we ask. Verse 38 says, ask the Lord of the harvest, therefore, to send out workers into his harvest field. Ask. Now the problem, of course, is we don't like to ask. We don't like to ask. We don't like to ask people. Well, I don't like to ask people. I would tell the story of Alpha all the time. You know that if I'm out in a car and I don't know where I'm going, I refuse to wind the window down and ask anybody. If I can't figure it out through Google Maps on my phone, I'll drive around and miss it for 3 hours, but I'm definitely not going to ask anybody. Completely embarrassing to do that. Totally undermining. So, no, actually. You wouldn't be like that, possibly as stubborn as that, but you might be like that in other areas that you would never ask. You wouldn't ask for help. It would be below your dignity or whatever. And that's what we do with God. For all those who complain that God has not answered prayers, there are at least as many who never actually asked. But Jesus did. That's kind of one of the amazing things about Jesus' life. He was always asking the Father. The scripture relates it over and over again. And in this command, when Jesus gives to us, ask the Lord of the harvest. In this command, Jesus is inviting us to discover what he discovered about himself and about prayer. There's a prophecy about this in the Old Testament, in Psalm chapter, in the second Psalm, it says this. God is speaking. You are my son, he says. Today I have become your father. Ask me. Ask me. And I will make the nations your inheritance, the ends of the earth your possession. Ask me, he says. And I'll give you the whole world. And here, I think, we get a look into those nights of prayer in the hills of Galilee. Those times when Jesus was on his own before the Father. What was he doing? He was asking for the world. Ask me. That's what the Father said. Ask me, and I'll give you the nations. I'll give you the ends of the earth. Just ask me. So Jesus asked. And he encourages us to do the same. You know, most of the time, God must be like we sometimes are. You know, when we offer somebody help. Say, look, can I help you? You know, whatever it might be. And so they finally and reluctantly agree to be helped. And they say, well, could you do this for me? Sometimes we look at them and we say, is that all? Is that all? Is there nothing more I can do? Kind of remind me a bit, you know, of that scene in The Lion King, if you remember, you know, where Simba and Nala get caught by the three hyenas in a cave, in the elephant grave, you know, and Simba's trying to be the big man to protect the girl who's with him, and so he kind of shapes himself up, small as he is, beside the hyenas, and they say to him, roar then. And so he has a go, and he roars, and out of this tiny little body comes this excuse of a lion's roar. And the hyenas look at him and they say, is that it? And I surmise that for most of the time when God listens to you and me praying, that's what he's doing. He's looking at us and he's saying, is that it? Is that the best you can do? Is that as much as you can ask for? Ask me, he says, and I'll give you the nations for your inheritance and the ends of the earth for your possession. Sometimes we need to ask for more. Remember what Jesus has said, ask. In the midst of the devastation that was Israel, the enemy had wreaked havoc through the people of God. They were leaderless. God says, ask me. Just ask me. And I'll give you leaders to lead. But we need to see something else here. Because this command, ask the Lord of the harvest, therefore, to send out workers into his harvest field. This command does something else. It invites us into a conversation, a relationship. One that Jesus himself already shared. That's what prayer is. Jesus was on the hillsides of Galilee in the small hours of the morning talking with his Father, not just because he needed to ask him for the world, but because the process of asking invited him to continue that fellowship, that conversation that had been his since before the world began, the Father and the Son and the Spirit together. And that's what prayer is. Our asking is an invitation into a conversation. Sometimes I hate my job. I can think of a couple of times recently in the last few months when the one of my sons who remains at home with us said to me when he came in from work, Dad, there's a film on tonight. Would you come with me to the film? And I have to say, no, I can't go because I've got a meeting of some sort to go to. Because if my grown-up son wants to spend time with me to go to do something and watch a film, I'm kind of blown away by that, you know? Why would he want to do something as uncool as that? I have to say no, because it's not just an invitation to go to a film. It's an invitation into a friendship, into a relationship, into a conversation. It's brilliant. And that's what this command is all about. Jesus says, ask. You know, it's an invitation into a conversation with God. What are we missing? By not taking up that invitation. I didn't sleep very well Thursday night into Friday morning. And it's one of those nights when you dream crazy dreams and you're waking up 2 or 3 times and you watch the clock and you think, am I going to get up and make a cup of tea or am I going to lie here in bed and hope that I will eventually get off to sleep? And you never really do. And you should have got up and made the cup of tea or done something useful with the time, but you don't. And at 6 o'clock, I got up, go to the loo, and as I did so, I heard a voice invite me into a conversation. I heard the Lord say, don't go back to bed, just go into the study and talk to me. I was knackered. I was so tired. I could barely keep my eyes open. I hadn't slept most of the night. I got back into bed and I missed the conversation. And That's the way it is for so much of the time, for so many of us, perhaps not at 6 o'clock in the morning, but we don't hear what Jesus is saying here. We see prayer as a burden. We see it as something that is that we're frightened of or not sure about or it never really worked for us. And so we walk away from it. We're walking away from an invitation from the King of Kings to get involved in a conversation with him. Ask me, he said. Ask me. Jesus said we need to ask. He said we need to ask wisely. Let's not forget the context here. The context of this invitation is the leaderless nation of Israel and the wreckage and damage that the enemy has been doing as a result of that leaderless state. Not that he didn't have leaders, but the leaders were not concerned about what God wanted. They were more concerned to curry favor with the people. And we are to ask the Lord to provide real leaders for his church. We're to ask him about that. Now in this church, we frequently pray for a lot of people, for their needs and for those of their families and their friends, just like we did earlier in the service this morning. We do it in all sorts of ways. We have a prayer list that for most of the year circulates around prayer groups, and on that list will be, perhaps not by their full name or not always with details that you can identify them, but there will be individual circumstances on there that people are invited to pray for, and we do that. Not only do we have a prayer list, we have a prayer line. When the prayer list ceases, I have a facility that somebody tells me about a need or tells Jean about a need. We can forward that through Karen, and those details will be sent out. People will pray for that. Furthermore, every single Sunday at every service of worship, we offer prayer ministry at the end of worship. And every week, we pray for loads and loads of people. And this is good. There are people sitting in this building today, including me, who can testify for how God moved as a result of those prayers. He healed us or answered a need that we had or gave us guidance that we really required. There are loads of people here today. Put their hand up and say, yes, God worked through a prayer that someone prayed for me in prayer ministry in this church. That's great. But we are also commanded to pray for God to send out workers. And I'm suggesting that in this context, Jesus has in mind those who will lead God's people. We are learning here about an important priority in our prayers. The priority we're learning about is that whilst we are free to pray for anybody or anything, that conversation is open. God doesn't put restrictions on it. But in that conversation, God's concerns must come first. The things that he thinks are important are the things that he is primarily asking us to talk to him about. And this is not easy. But the Bible shows how getting that right changes the outcome of prayer. Let me give you an example in the Old Testament. Solomon, king of Israel, became king. He grew up in a royal palace, so he was no stranger to the kingship of what it would mean. He understood monarchy really well. He understood the people. But as a young monarch, he faced the pressure of his high office. And in 2 Chronicles chapter 1, God says to him one night, ask, there it is again. God says to Solomon, ask for whatever you want me to give you. It was kind of like, you know, a shopping trolley dash in a supermarket. You know, sometimes you win those things as a prize. They give you a shopping trolley and you've got 5 minutes. You go round the ends and you can gather as much as you possibly can. And everything you can get in your trolley, you take out the door at the end. That's kind of what God said to Solomon. Ask for whatever you want me to give you. Here he was with his trolley in the divine supermarket and he could take away anything he wanted. But Solomon decides to ask for the one thing that will make him a better leader. Give me wisdom and knowledge that I may lead this people. He realized he had a heavy responsibility, one that he wasn't equipped to fulfill. So he said, give me the strength so I can lead them well. And the result was that God said this to him, wisdom and knowledge will be given you. You will have what you asked. And I will also give you wealth, possessions, and honor. He didn't ask for it, became his as well, because he asked for what God thought was important. The And Jesus had already told the disciples about this in the mountain. We read these verses a number of weeks ago. We were looking at chapter 6 of Matthew. Seek first the kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. Now, that doesn't mean that God's going to make us all millionaires, okay? That's not going to happen. He's not going to make us a king. He's not even going to make us a prince. He's probably not going to take us out of the current house we're living in and the current job that we really don't like that much. We're probably still going to have to do all that stuff, all right? But it does mean that if we get the priority right, and if we ask, if we use the opportunity to have this conversation with God and put what concerns God up front as a big priority for ourselves, then what we discover is that a lot of the rest of the stuff that we would like to have put first on the list ends up getting taken care of too. That's the amazing kind of God that he is. So we need to ask wisely to put God's concerns for his church and the world first. And we will never be personally disadvantaged by that. If we get God's concerns first, it will never do us down. He will still look after us. He will still meet our needs. He will still be there for us. My question is this: who asked the Lord to give us leaders who will lead the church to the lost? Who will ask the Lord to give us leaders who will lead the church to the lost? Ask the Lord of the harvest to send workers into his harvest field. Who will ask that? Who will make that a number one priority in their prayers? Lord, if you could get our church right, if you could get our outreach right, if you could get our leadership right, then that would be really important to us. And when that becomes important to us, then God tends to the other things as well. I love a stanza from Kevin Crush's song, Show Your Power. Lines go like this: we ask not for riches, but look to the cross. You are the Lord. And for our inheritance, give us the lost. You are the Lord. Jesus says, ask for this. Ask, start a conversation with God. But when you ask, ask wisely. Ask for this. For our inheritance, give us the lost. The answer to that prayer will change everything. It will change our function. It will change our community. And it will change our lives. For God, who gives us that priority, will look after the other things as well. I was really proud yesterday. I know pride's a sin, and I confess it before you all. But I was proud. I was proud of my son-in-law, actually. Because we had the 2020 Cup yesterday, and Phil and Andy and all the other guys had put that cup together. It was an incredible experience. It was like probably about 200 people there, between those taking part in the football, 24 teams that were in it, and then wives and family members and other hangers-on who came along. And it was such a fabulous day. We needed the Lord to give us two great days this summer, and we got both of them. Yesterday was one of them. It was an incredible morning that we spent together with all these guys, you know. And at the end of it, we were giving out the cups, the awards to the three teams that had won the various sections of the competition. And Phil got up to call them all. They were up busy eating burgers with some difficulties in getting them there to actually receive their awards. But we eventually got them forward. I was going to hand the awards over. And before I did, he thanked everybody who had taken part. He thanked everybody who had organized. And then he testified. He said, he invited all the lads to come to church. He said, you know, I'm a Christian, and I discovered that being a Christian, God has changed my life and given me a joy that I would love each of you to experience. And if you'd like to come to our church, we would really be glad to welcome you. It was just a really short testimony. Quite a difficult set of circumstances. Most of these lads that don't go anywhere near church are not really that interested in it. I was kind of so proud in that moment, not just because he happens to be married to my daughter, but because here was a young Christian man from my congregation who wasn't ashamed to say who he was and to ask God to do something in their lives. What is to prevent God from bringing every single one of those 200 people to know Jesus as Savior? Ask me, he says, I'll give the nations to you. And so, in our service today, I love us to start that journey. Maybe you're already on it. Maybe you're asking God for these things all the time. That's great if you are. I see some people write up stuff in the house of prayer along these lines, and I'm so thankful to God for all of them, you know. But maybe I would like to encourage you this morning to start this journey and start this conversation.